It's happening, readers. We have heard that you want paperbacks from our tailored book recommendation service called TBR. And I'm delighted to let you know that we're going to be in sync with your request. That's right. We're bringing paperbacks. Whether you hate carrying around bulky hardcovers, you're on a budget, you want a wider range of recommendations, or all of the above, now you can get a paperback subscription from TBR curated just for you by one of our bibliologists. Get all the details at mytbr.co. That's mytbr.co. We're bringing paperbacks.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. I'm Jeff O'Neill.
And I'm Rebecca Shinsky.
And today we're talking about sort of a mini smorgasbord of literary adaptations that are out. These are all TV shows that we're going to be talking about today. They're all streaming. All of them... No, they're not all done. I don't think. I think there's another episode of Shogun. We didn't have it on our list, but I was going to talk about Shogun for a few minutes too because I'm up on
please.
That. And so we're going to do Masters of Air, Shogun, Three Body Problem, Ripley, Gentleman in Moscow in some order. And I think we have varying levels of exposure and enthusiasm for all of them. There's no...
I think
we double home runs, no double barreled thumbs up. That would be a weird thing for AI. That would be a good AI thing, double barreled thumbs up, AI art. I don't think there are any eulogies for turkeys here. No foul burials here. So it's kind of an interesting mix to get into.
Yeah, no turkeys. And of course, if you want to take a few minutes, I haven't seen Dune 2. So if you want to talk about Dune, with it being the signal big adaptation of the season, we can spare some time for the sandworms.
All right. We'll Dune 2 at the end, maybe for a few minutes. This is more of your domain than mine these days. Where would you like to begin?
Let's see. I'm curious about which ones of these you have seen. Actually, why don't we start with Shogun? Because you've seen that.
Okay. Shogun is the best of all of these I have exposure to. I have not seen a frame of Masters of the Air. The only reason for that is we are trying to find a time where Michelle, Ames, and I can watch it without our daughter. And it's kind of a weird combination where we'd have... I don't know, 8 hours or even 1 hour or 2 hours every now and again to blast it out. I feel like it's going to be like 3 months and all of a sudden like Rowan's gone for the day for a birthday party something and we just go Goblin Corps and just sort of watch the aerial bombardment of Europe for 8 hours. So that's the one I haven't seen any. I watched two of Ripley. I watched one Gentleman of Moscow. I'm all caught up on Shogun and I've seen all of Three Body Problem.
Oh,
so
okay.
I guess that's sort of an order of ascending exposure.
We're kind of upside down on these then. I finished Ripley. I've seen two Gentlemen in Moscow, which is all that's out. They've only released two.
Yep.
I've seen six of the nine episodes of Masters of the Air, and I watched the first episode of Three Body Problem, which I'm going to keep going on, but I only had time for the one so far. And I haven't watched any
Shogun. Let's meet in the middle with Ripley, because I don't think we've talked about, though I feel through 90s osmosis, that we probably both have... mad affection for the Matt Damon, Jude Law, Paltrow, Philip Seymour Hoffman adaptation of Ripley. We both have, I know we both like Andrew Scott. It's quite beautiful. It's the kind of the, I think it's probably the signal literary adaptation, not so, for a couple of reasons. One, I think probably more people have read this novel or a Ripley novel. It's Andrew Scott. Netflix is putting a lot behind it. And that 90, was it 95, that adaptation?
99.
I should have looked this up. 99. That adaptation has a lot of Q rating, Q brownie points amongst people of our generation. And I still think it holds up terrifically. And Ripley, Tom Ripley, you wouldn't think of him necessarily if you were like, let's do the top 50 literary characters of all time. But if you really saw it and thought about it, you'd be like, oh, yes. Now we're talking. So let's start there, Rebecca.
Okay. Yes, I agree. I do have a ton of affection for the 1999 adaptation. Jude Law in that as Dickie Greenleaf was like formative for me.
That's very important to a lot of people of a persuasion.
Yes. Yeah. It was very important to me. I rewatched it last week or a week or so ago and was like, damn, it holds up. It's beautiful. It's so glamorous.
It's so beautiful.
The vibe between them is just like, it's that version of it is like shiny and seductive. And they add a lot of things to the story that aren't in the book, which I remember learning. Mm-hmm. I was in high school when Talented Mr. Ripley came out. I was at, like, you know, just ripe for the Matt Damon of it all. And I didn't read The Talented Mr. Ripley until college, when I was just, you know, trying to, like, catch up on things that I don't think I even knew it was a book when I saw it in high school. And then it was like, oh, my mind is blown. Let me find out about this. And I remember being shocked by how much darker in tone and content the book is than that 1999 adaptation. Yes. But I do love it. It's gorgeous. That Anthony Minghella version, it's like, it's absolutely phenomenal.
It's golden. That's the only way I can describe it. It's sort of golden in shooting, and also hitting Paltrow, Law, and Damon, and in Hoffman in really interesting, I often refer to it as Bad Will Hunting in a lot of ways. Because he's coming off Good Will Hunting. Damon is playing this virtuosic young man who is naive but eminently capable. Whereas, you know, if Will Hunting had broke bad and decided to be a con man, he might not look a lot different. I mean, a different class for sure. And the book is much darker. The Steven Zahn adaptation that's on Netflix now is... it's brighter because it's black and white, and you get a lot of white marble in contrast on your TV when you're watching this, but it is both smaller and quieter and darker than the 1999 adaptation. So how did you find the Netflix? What would you say? What's your 30-second appraisal of
adaptation? I don't know that anything can replace the 99 film in my heart as, like, the canonical adaptation of Ripley, but I think this is a more faithful adaptation of the story, and I think it captures how wily the character is much better. Like, there are some iconic moments in the film where Matt Damon, like, when he first turns to Jude Law and mimics that Dickie Greenleaf's dad's voice, and we get, like, oh, this character, he can take on other personalities, he's very sly, there's more going on here than what meets the eye, he's maybe not as naive as he's coming across. But I felt like Andrew Scott's version of it was calculating, it's more sinister. The black and white shooting really brings across the vibe of this is a noir story. Mm-hmm. And he's a bad guy from the beginning. Like, the 99 film, it kind of feels a little Breaking Bad-ish. Like he just sort of falls into this situation and then sees some opportunities to break bad. In the Netflix version, we can see that Andrew Scott's character is, like, he's up to no good from the get-go. He's an opportunist and, like, is much more strategic about how he is embodying this relationship with Dickie and Marge and what he's trying to achieve from it. It's just so much darker in so many ways. I learned in some of my background reading this morning about it that this was originally a Showtime series, and that after it had been completely shot, they sold it. Like, when the Showtime Paramount situation happened, they lifeboated themselves over to Netflix. And that explained a lot to me of, like, this feels more prestige-y than what Netflix typically does. It's like, oh, that, right. They did a lot with the 8 hours also, I thought. Like, I wondered going in, will this get baggy in the way that a lot of 8-episode series can feel like they're stretching it out? But it turns into kind of a procedural, like, in the back half. Mm-hmm. We spend about half the time with the folks that are tracking Tom Ripley, and the rest of the time watching him try to stay one step ahead of them. And that, all of those aspects of it, I thought were really fun. So I ended up really, really loving it. I took the whole thing down in, like, 2 days.
Yeah, I think I feel like it does and doesn't matter when you release these things. This would have been an unbelievable summer drop, because even in black and white, it feels like a summer hang. And the 99 version feel much more like a noir version of a great F. Scott Fitzgerald novel. Mm-hmm. Like, it feels more like this.
Glitzy. Yeah.
This feels more like, you know, Dashiell Hammett on the Amalfi Coast. So I'm trying to sort of describe through other references what the vibe is. I can't help but see it through the 99 version. I think it throws it into some relief. This one, I think, is quite a bit more faithful. Both, it's been a long time since I read the original, and there's several Ripley books, and I think I've read a couple of them. Pardon me for the reader's fog. The decades, you know, a reader's fog of decades
it
is
happens.
A real thing.
But
I think there's a directionality to Tom Ripley that's meaningfully different in the adaptations. The Damon is a young man, you know, kind of a fresh out of college, in college. Has a, I don't remember if they say he's a Midwesterner, but he's got big Midwesterner vibes. I related a lot to him about 2 years later when I came as a precocious but naive country boy to the big city, right? And, it, you know, I'm not Matt Damon by any stretch of the imagination, but there was a certain homology in the shape where I was, you know, I was smart but naive and a bit of a bumpkin in my own way and really felt out of place. Now, I'm not going to go murder people with a marble bust. That's not my intention. But there is, I did relate a lot to the, this is a different social, experiential, global class than I'm used to. And I've got a lot of catching up to do.
Yes.
You know, I'm not of them. And so he's a more of a striver. With time, he could have been a member of that class, I guess is another way of putting it. If he had been patient and, you know, gone to law school and all that kind of stuff, he could be a member of that class, or his kids could have been, I should say. The Tom Ripley we meet in the Zayn, the Netflix adaptation, is he's hitting every ladder on the way down, right? He's at a rock bottom place. He makes this move, this deal, to go try to convince Dickie Greenleaf to come home out of desperation. He initially doesn't want to do it, right? Mm-hmm. He's like, this is weird. I don't want to do this. But he's basically, you know, he is a catch me if you can. He's one scene away from a bad catch me if you can ending, essentially, until he gets this thing from Dickie Greenleaf's dad. And you get so much more of a sense of his background, whereas the Tom Ripley in the 99 is more of a mystery till later. You see it through his eyes a little bit differently, right. And that matters a lot. And I think it makes it darker. Also, he seems less of an enigma. There's something about the enigma of the Damon Ripley and where is this guy coming from and all the things that go into it, where that one, it felt like some of his slippages were almost intentional to make himself more like a bumpkin, where this one we see that his slippages are just because he doesn't know anything yet. Like, he's a quick study, but he doesn't know a hawk from a handsaw. And that's pretty interesting to see him kind of almost drown. Well, I guess literally and figuratively, because he doesn't like the water. But, you know, he is really holding on for dear life. And it gives it a sort of desperation that you don't get in the first one. And I think the black and white helps that. It's also the budget. So the 99 version is a big budget, late 90s. I think it's a Miramax production. Like, they spent money. Like, there's scenes in this where there's hundreds of people at a, you know, on the street, where there's multiple cars moving. Well, this one, if you look at it, you can see that the budget, there's not as many people. These are big, barren, empty rooms, empty sidewalks, weirdly. I don't know if it's the off scene or what it is, but it's much more depopulated. And I think that has a certain sort of weird agoraphobic claustrophobia. There's sort of a weird tension there about how big these spaces are, but also feels quite small and confining at the same time. So those are just my initial reactions. Two episodes in, I should say. I'm just two episodes in.
Yeah, it's, I think the point that the 99 version, Damon's version of it, he's in over his head, and like, he knows it from the very beginning that he's in over his head, and he's wide-eyed and like trying to figure it out. He's walking on the beach in that like neon green Speedo situation and his dress shoes just looking so incredibly out of place. There's a version of that in Andrew Scott's, but it's more like he knows this world, or he knows enough of this world to figure out how to pass, but it's in the details that he is going to slip. He's going to pick out the ugly paisley robe and then find out when he gets there that like no sophisticated man would ever wear this. And there's actually there was a piece I read this morning that was comparing, or that was saying that like that paisley robe is actually part of like the queer coding of the Ripley character, which is, those are interesting distinctions between the two versions as well, like that there is some sort of attraction, at least on Tom's part, to Dickie, I think is a little clearer in the Matt Damon version. Andrew Scott's Ripley does not seem romantically drawn to Dickie. It seems pretty clear that Dickie is just a utility for him on his way to, you know, trying to get,
or he wants to be him, right? I mean, that's a different kind of thing, right? He starts imitating very quickly.
It's not that he, it's not so much that he wants to be with him, it's that he wants to be him, and those get confused and like crossed over in the Damon version, much less, or much more than they do in the Netflix version. And then near the end of the Netflix series, after Freddie Miles has died, like we get,
a different exploration of, you know, where queer men sit sort of in the 1950s, the early 60s in culture and the sort of assumptions that are made about them and how Ripley is able to play on and around those to get away with what he gets away with. I thought it was really, really well done. And the black and whiteness was just, it was a real pleasure to watch. Yeah. It also, I thought, I had some questions about Netflix dropping it all in one go. Like, am I really supposed to sit and just marathon my way through these 8 hours? And it doesn't feel like it's shot that way. Like, this rewards close attention. We've talked some about how the streamers are designing a lot of content to be consumed while you're also like half on your phone through it. But this is like, there's a lot of subtitles. There are a lot of really subtle things that Andrew Scott is doing with his face. If you look away from the screen, you are missing some kind of important information. And I appreciated that experience of like, I'm going to watch three of these in a row, but it's going to be three like really focused hours of paying attention to what's happening here. You can't really be doing something else while you're watching it, or you do miss something that's important.
And I'd say for this one, you're going to know pretty quick if you like the vibe.
I think that's
like,
right.
In, you know, once they get him to Italy, and which I think is through the episode one, give it the, I think this drop two and then go week to week is the move. I think that is the Goldilocks for all of these kinds of series. I'll just say that, you know, I'm sure there's distinction through everything else, but at one episode I would be like, is that enough? But two, I'm like, okay, you get the world, you get some, you have to world build and give people a hook. And maybe that's good transition to something I think is less successful, but still interesting, which is Gentlemen in Moscow.
Yes.
But let's take a quick break and go over there.
It's happening, readers. We have heard that you want paperbacks from our tailored book recommendation service called TBR. And I'm delighted to let you know that we're going to be in sync with your request. That's right. We're bringing paperbacks. Whether you hate carrying around bulky hardcovers, you're on a budget, you want a wider range of recommendations, or all of the above, now you can get a paperback subscription from TBR curated just for you by one of our bibliologists. Get all the details at mytbr.co. That's mytbr.co. We're bringing paperbacks.
So we both have done... Well, you've done two, I've done one. There's only two out, so we're, you know, ballparky in the right situation. I will watch at least another one of these, I should say, here. We both have great affection for you probably have a fresher memory of it than me because you've read it more recently. But
I'm a Johnny come lately to the Gentleman in Moscow.
Well, I don't know. It's fine. It's historical fiction about the Bolshevik Revolution set in a hotel. I don't think it's all courant in a way you need to be super worried about when you got on board. This is an Ewing McGregor vehicle. I think that's pretty clear. I think the book itself is a vehicle for this character in a lot of different ways. We find a... So if you don't know what the story is, I guess we can give a little bit of background so you can understand the context for which we're discussing the show. Is a count, a form... Well, whether or not he's still a nobility is kind of at play a little bit, both in spirit and in actuality in the book and the show so far. But he plays this Russian count who has come back to Moscow after the Russian Revolution of 1917. And I don't remember this as well from the book, and tell me what liberties they may have taken. But in the movie, he's come back to get his grandmother onto a boat, right? We're still going through cleansing out the nobility, enemies of the state. It's gone from the first wave of cleansing to a second, tawdrier, still bloody, but sort of tawdrier and more vindictive and, you know, more of a police state than the real turbulent revolutionary era. And you know, he's put his life at risk. He knows it. It's brought up to him several times. Why'd you come back? What have you done here? And he has a poem attributed to him from 5-6 years before that has some ostensibly, if you squint, you can see some sympathy for the revolution or the working people or the proletariat, right? Which prevents him from being put against the wall, but does not also allow him to sort of nestle into the warm embrace of the emergent Soviet Union. And this sort of strange compromise is that he can live, but he has to stay within the confines of this Metropole Hotel, which is a last bastion of a certain worldly, cosmopolitan Russia/global city. People come and go through it. He lives in somewhat reduced circumstances, but he's still there. And then it follows him through the next decades of his existence and how he navigates it, how he finds meaning, how he doesn't, and ultimately what happens. And I don't want to spoil it. I think for the book, The Pleasures, we talked a little bit on a recent episode, it is urbane, it is sophisticated, but approachable. It is probably 3 degrees easier than a Tolstoy or Dostoevsky novel, but it's in the same, it's a shallower end of the same pool where it's sort of talking about class in these worlds and the mannerisms, but it's not that difficult to get through. It's not that long. It's not that heady. It's frankly, it's not that philosophical or political, which makes it the easier to go down. The play is, the fun of it is in the Count's sort of winning and naive sophistication, and as he is also trying to navigate this new world and sort of find his place in it. And the vibe of the book, I would say, feels a little bit like Wes Anderson with an edge. Like it's a Grand Budapest Hotel with like a smidge of Dostoevsky in it. And in the show, it's played quite a bit darker. McGregor's winning smile, his affability, is the sort of this soul levity that we get. But I felt like there was a lightness to the book that I'm not seeing so far in the show. Yeah. Rebecca, is that close to what you're seeing, or tell me where you are?
I think that's right. They've moved some things around in the plot line and added some elements to the plot that ramp up the tension. Like one of the things that makes the book go down so easy is that he's in these, you know, depressing circumstances and is just like committed to not being depressed. He's like relentlessly cheerful, and he talks about that as one of his values, and like that's that is what it is. It's what makes a book about a relatively dark topic go down so easy, and why Amor Towles was able to sell a floppity jillion copies of this, like, because it goes down so much better than a Tolstoy novel does. It doesn't feel like homework. It's interesting, like, they have left out so far some of the dark elements from the book, like when he does have a dark night of the soul. I haven't seen that on screen yet. I don't know if they're going to get there in the third or fourth episode, but if they get there, it should be coming up pretty soon. And then they've sort of invented additional sources of tension for the show, because the book just sort of, it flows along like the first,
you're living with them. Yeah. You're just kind of living with them for a while.
I think when I pictured, since I just, like, I would not have read this if it hadn't have been a Ewan McGregor vehicle coming up. I had just kind of resigned myself to, like, at some point I'll figure out what people are on about with Amor Towles. But The Gentleman in Moscow would not have been my first pick just based on, you know, like, summaries of the book. So I was expecting, based on the book, for there to be like a lot of montages and for us to be in the repetition with him of like his days and his weeks are very repetitive because he can't leave this place. And there's a way that that's a grind. And there's also a way that you can find like pockets of loveliness in it. And that's what the character succeeds in doing. And the show has not decided to live in those spaces. It's sort of picking the moments of like highest tension or moments of conflict. He meets the, you know, Anna Urbanova, this actress that he begins a relationship with, and it's just like, it's very charming, the meet cute in the book, and they ramp up the tension for that in the second episode. So that, like, just to spoil it a little, it's pretty memorable in the book where they sleep together the first time and he's like very enamored of her, and she rolls over in the middle of the night and she's just like, basically like, close the curtains on your way out, and he's like, oh, I guess I'm just gonna, you know, put my trousers on and pad back to my room with my shoes in my hand, like a little walk of shame moment for him. In the episode where they meet in the show, they sleep together the first time and they're like laying in bed and he says something that she takes offense to, and then they kind of have a little moment and she kicks him out. And so there's just like added conflict.
I have a sense, and tell me if I'm wrong, I feel like in a, I don't know if in a fundamental way, but in a meaningful way, the adaptation doesn't trust what made the book interesting.
I think that's right.
In a couple of moments, right? It says explicitly some lines that you don't ever get explicitly, but because you live with the Count, you live in these places, you know, like, it just tried to do that, right? And part of what was the, I guess, the sweet and sour, the quiet loud that the book pulls off is, if you know anything about anything when it comes to world history, that to be a count in 1918 Russia is perilous. We don't need to start with a tribunal and say all this. We just don't. Like, one of the things the book does is it warms you up to it. Maybe you don't understand everything, but you understand the fundamental truth, which is he is a man out of time, right? And he's found this, like, kind of weird time capsule. And it's almost a Kafka-esque kind of bureaucratic loophole that he's living in. And that kind of absurdity, the adaptation, the streaming version has no sense of. It has no feel for. He kind of lucked out in this bizarro situation and is living out the reducto ad absurdum consequences of it, where it doesn't feel, and somehow the book that makes sense. I never questions like why he's, this would never happen. Atals is really amazing at that, where the book is like, they're like, I'm going to keep you in this thing, and why don't I shoot you? And it just feels like this is our conceit, and it doesn't have a groundedness that feels real. And then the way the book somehow magically pulls off.
Right, yeah. There are a lot of, like, fist fights in the first two episodes, and somebody pulls a gun. And, you know, I'm looking at the Paramount Plus logo on it right now and thinking about, like, Paramount is also what's behind, you know, Kevin Costner and Yellowstone and all of that kind of stuff. And I think they've taken a story that relied on subtlety. The book is mostly a vibe.
and some of the pleasure, like you say, in that first 100 pages, like, how does he get his haircut? How does he get his shoes cleaned? What are they eating? What is the chef doing to make up so they can't make salt and buca? And we get some of those beats, but it takes 9 seconds.
Yes.
Well, that's a pleasurable 3 pages in the book just to figure some of that stuff out.
And it's just, like, I think that they didn't trust the show to be a vibe, and so they've ramped it up and to have more conflict, to be darker, to make some of the subtleties of the book much more explicit, which takes away a lot of the pleasure of things that are subtle. And I never want a narrator, really. Like, I don't ever really want a voiceover in something like this, but I keep finding myself thinking there are places where this version of this adaptation would benefit from some sort of voiceover that gives us a little more, because the Count, You know, we're not, he doesn't narrate the book. We're not in his head, but we know plenty about his thoughts and his feelings. And his interiority does not come across really at all in this adaptation. Yeah. That every afternoon after lunch, he wanders up to his study and he tilts back in his chair and he reads a couple Montaigne, essays and is pondering life and trying to stay, you know, educated and erudite and somehow connected to the world while he is literally physically disconnected from the world, except for whoever happens to pass through the doors of the place. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like they missed it. They missed the mark. Like, there's a twinkle in Ewan McGregor's eye.
I mean, he's terrific to watch. I mean, he just isn't anything.
This is a great character for him. Yeah. And the moments that he's on screen with the little girl who plays Nina, those are really charming. Like, that's a good hang. They are the best hang in the book, and they are definitely the best hang in the show so far. I finished the second episode last night, and I think I'm out. This is not the adaptation of this book that I want to read. Like, I think it just missed all the things, as you were saying, or missed a lot of the things that make the book so charming, that let it go down easy, but also that do capture what's going on in Russia at this time, why the stakes are high. Like, it's never far from the Count's mind how he ended up there or what he's missing out on and what's happening to other people, what has happened and what is happening to other people that he loves. But there are ways to do that I think would have been more faithful to the feeling of the book. And if you really loved A Gentleman in Moscow when you read it, I don't think this adaptation is giving you the hit you're looking for when you kind of sit down and watch it.
So I guess one of a couple of our theories of adaptations is, in order for them to be truly satisfying someone who likes the book, the source text, is a couple of things. One is to be extraordinarily faithful so you see the thing brought to life, right? So it captures the thing. The other way to go is to do something different so it offers you something in excess of what the text does. So, I mean, it's taking a version of it and giving you something a little bit more. I couldn't help that this version of it was actually giving me less. Mm-hmm. This wasn't giving me anything more or really different. Well, it was different, but it wasn't added. That difference didn't
produce it's not additive,
new things or new feelings. In fact, I felt it made it smaller in feeling and sentiment. And really, as a thought experiment, too, because there's element by the time you get to the end of the book, you know, him, the obvious comparisons to Montaigne, so far as I'm reading it, is Montaigne had his self-imposed exile. The Count's exile in this building requires him to get back to sort of basics. What matters to him? What can he care about? What's worth living for, right? Mm-hmm. He doesn't have anything to live for, which means he can live for anything as long as it's within the purview of his hotel. And it becomes kind of like Never Let Me Go, a parable, right? It has a parable-like, a fable-like quality. Mm-hmm. Aren't we all trapped in our own little worlds, right? Aren't we all just sort of, you know, you could go anywhere, but the things that really matter are caring for people around you and the relationships and standing for something. Like, it doesn't matter whether you're trapped in a hotel or you have the whole world at your fingertips. The essential things are kind of the same in a certain way. And one thing, I guess, to spoil the, a interior or sort of philosophical point is the Count finds a certain kind of liberation in caring about things within his purview, right? And yeah. And then ultimately also decides what's worth risking something for, what's worth leaving something for. And it's quite beautiful and touching in its own way. And I don't doubt there will be something like that. But I find it to be a quite a bit less sophisticated version of something you come to for sophistication, which leaves it feeling like drinking a Diet Coke when what you want is the real thing to some degree. Okay.
Okay.
Let's see. Let's proceed through something we both have a little bit of exposure to. I guess that would bring us to three body problem, and then we'll invert the scales to some degree. Tell me about your experience of watching one episode like a ghoul of Three Body Problem. That is a weird thing to come and bring to us today, is to do one of these.
I intended to do more. It's just that over the weekend, I only got one down. I am going to finish it. So my, like, you know, folks who listen to this show know that I'm not great at building worlds in my head, so I'm not going to read The Three-Body Problem. Like, a big work of science fiction is just not something that I'm good at reading or that I enjoy. Like, I find it frustrating. Bob read and loved these. You've read them. I know a lot of folks, you know, really admire the book. And so we've had conversations in our house about, like, what is this about? What's the technology? And he was like, you're going to enjoy the central questions of it. So just get in there. I also trust a big adaptation to, like, explain the science of a thing to its audience pretty clearly and in a way that, like, is not dumbed down, but that is less complicated than what you might get in a 700-page novel. And that's what I'm here for. Like, I want the Cliff's Notes version of the science in this kind of stuff. Like, let me understand the basics. So the first episode, I thought, did really well. It grounds you in the history of this place, the conflict around intellectual freedom, or really suppression of the scientific method and suppression of scientific ideas, how we've ended up here. And then you get the gist that, like, science is broken. Something is going on. The particle colliders are all giving bad results. And for some reason that may or may not be related to that, scientists around the world are killing themselves. And there's an investigation. Benedict Wong is investigating, and I'm here for anything with Benedict Wong. So, like, sign
me up.
Can
we get Ewan McGregor out of Gentleman in Moscow and Benedict Wong out of this and put them in something? Well, anyway,
together?
I like Three Body. I find myself enjoying Three Body Problem more. I think, well, anyway, but Wong is, the show may not work if that character doesn't work. He's doing a lot of structure in the show, I think. Anyway, go keep
going. Oh, interesting. Yeah. So, like, yeah, all I know about this is what I've learned about it from the adaptation, really. So, science is broken. They're investigating why. And at the end of the first episode, there's a discovery of what's basically like a golden VR helmet where folks who have died have been playing with this VR video game, and it is somehow it is somehow connected to the ways in which science is broken. We do see one of the scientist characters on screen starts to she starts to see a, like, countdown clock just appear in front of her constantly. It's not, we're not given to believe it's like a hallucination. We are given to believe it's really there. She is really seeing this. Other people see it. And there is, it's a countdown on her life, apparently. And there is some way to try to circumvent it. So that's where we are. I think it's a fascinating premise. The whole, like, science is broken, what's going on, is a really interesting
cool
setup.
Right?
Yeah.
Yes.
It's a cool,
very cool.
That is a cool setup. If that were the pitch to, like, a Matt Damon vehicle, sign me up. Science
Mark
is
Watney
broken.
Is like, wait a minute, what's going on here?
Right. And one man can find out why.
Yeah.
Yeah, I will keep going because I'm interested in figuring out how science is broken and what's up with this. I like the mystery of it all, maybe more than I, much more than I care about the science fiction of it
all.
Where are you having
finished it? I think that's right. I found myself really enjoying watching this show. At the same time, there's some big pieces of it that I think really don't work, which I think is actually a testament to the sort of underlying, overarching, I'm not sure where, but it's either foundational or structural that buttresses the whole thing. Boy, I'm in my architecture bag right now. Michelle would probably be correcting me about what I'm saying. But those pieces are so compelling that some of the stuff that doesn't work, I'm like, I just kind of power through it when Augie Salazar is on screen. Like, you know, there's some characters that don't work, some stuff that doesn't make any sense, especially later on. The signal set piece is really eye-catching, but makes absolutely no sense from a practical point of view. So there's an element to that. But I felt myself thinking that my heart was making the same kind of bargain that my heart makes with a Da Vinci Code. Which you realize it's sort of... dumb is not the right thing. But you have to suspend some disbelief and sort of turn a blind eye to ponytails and Mickey Mouse watches, because the idea that there is this group that's been harboring the children and ancestors of Christ for 1,000 years, cool. And that there's puzzles in Da Vinci schools is cool. That science is broken is cool. Now, does other stuff, gobbledygook, make a lot of sense? And I'm sure an astrophysicist and an art historian be like, you guys are nuts. This is complete garbage. Like, I do not care. I'm here for a good time, not a long time when it comes to a show like this. And it's really pretty fun. And the signal, I think, smart invention of the first season is this Oxford Five, this group of five astrophysicists who've been friends for a long time, who are the mentees of a notable astrophysicist. That's an invention from the book. Those people do not exist. It's not like we move some things around. Science is broken, but Benioff and Weiss are like, we need a group of friends to care about in this big thing. And the book itself also is super unwieldy. Like, there's interminable descriptions of the Sophons, which you haven't got to yet, and you'll know it when you see it, that you could imagine trying to explain a photon. Is there a photon or a proton? Exactly, doesn't matter. That can exist in 10 dimensions, so it's super small, but it's also the size of the world. Have fun with that. But some suspension of disbelief is your friend. Invent it here. But these characters, I think, are both smart and wrong in some degree. I think it's smart to make this group of characters that can do some of the work. They have their side quests and their own roles to play. I think the thing that struck me about them, though, is some of them are not very good actors, or they're not given much. I don't know what to say about a couple of them. But the other thing I found is they did not feel to me like the elite scientists of the world. Because here's one thing I know about Ivy League plus postgraduate students. The dudes and dudettes and dude thems are some weird folks. They are weird folks in all kinds of awesome ways. This feels like a group that could be brunching in Manhattan after getting off. Like, they don't... But they feel sort of like... they feel like TV versions of regular people, which means they're a little too good looking. They're, you know, they're good actors. They're well dressed. Astrophysicists at Oxford, I promise you, do not look and talk like this. They don't.
Yeah, so they're like, not up on
the internet. Not believable. Yeah, they're just not... Now, it doesn't mean they're all the same necessarily. But this felt like central casting out of the real world. And trust me when I tell you, these people are so much weirder than this. And awkward and neurodivergent and, you know, obsessed and unhygienic and also brilliant and funny and can be like all those different things. But like, there's sort of a weird flatness to that I kind of felt myself pushing against. It's like, I wouldn't believe this if you, again, I bumped up that more against there's aliens that are going to be here in 400 years. That's kind of the deal you make in science fiction, right?
Like manic pixie astrophysicists.
Yeah. Or it's more like gap model astrophysicists. Again, you can be any kind of thing, but some of the things that comes along with being an Oxford hotshot astrophysicist have some other weird secondary effects in how you behave and what your personality is.
Yeah, that like single-minded, the kind of single-minded focus that it takes to rise to the top of that kind of field does have impact on impact on and is fed by other choices and tendencies, like, you know, in your social life, in your personal life, in other sorts of things. And
I don't think Benioff and Weiss made a trip to the astrophysics program at MIT for inspiration. That's all.
They weren't hanging out at CERN. They should have consulted Robert Langdon.
They should have.
Event I want.
There you go. Yeah, Robert
the
Langdon.
The three-body Da Vinci problem.
Says, Da Vinci has solved this. He predicted this. But having said all of that, like, if you're feeling like you're bumping up against that, totally there with you. I totally get it. And I just kind of like let it wash over me. Okay. Because what I like is, here's a cool idea. What if we knew aliens were coming in 400 years? What if we, you know, there's, again, I'm going to spoil a little bit of the beginning just to get the hooks in it. What if an alien species told us on first contact, say, please, please, for your own sake, do not contact us, right? Mm. And what if you did it anyway, right? How would the world react to something like this? What would you do? Like, there's some the ideas and sort of science fiction presuppositions are so compelling and fascinating that I will forgive a lot in this. And I think it is different enough from the text that I'm curious to see where they go. Because they make some, the spirit is kind of the same, but also in science fiction fantasy, there is a pleasure just to seeing this thing brought to life. Like, how are we going to represent the VR headsets? How are we going to represent the sophons? How are we going to represent the stars blinking? And that's just cool. It is just cool. And there could be a version of Gentleman in Moscow where the hotel and the mise-en-scène is so compelling and beautifully shot and mm-hmm. obsessed with the details that you're just for the hang, but it doesn't do that. So maybe to kind of compare them both a little
bit. Yeah. Let me go back to your here for a good time, not a long time. Having seen eight episodes of this, how do you feel about a multi-season adaptation?
I think it works as a series, especially as, again, it's been a long time since I read the book. I feel like the Wong character gets to do more investigative stuff and investigate murders, right? As you might imagine, because they're, again, I'm going to spoil some stuff, but some stuff that happens to characters that don't exist in the book give you some more things to do in the adaptation, right? And so you get some interpersonal stuff. And I think both of them, interestingly, Gentleman in Moscow and Three-Body Problem, both have a central problem to tackle, is how do you represent the passage of long periods of time? It's something that books tend to be better at than film, even series, because 22 pages can feel longer than even 3 minutes of movie, right? Because in Gentleman in Moscow, we get this early montage of like the first 67 days, and it goes by so fast. It gives you no sense of the languidness of it, where even just 20 minutes of reading, you can have pleasure in the details, but you can feel like time, you kind of believe that time passes. And Three Body Problem has a similar problem with on steroids. And there's some weird ass things that I'm so curious to see what they're going to do with, because they are not. This one, I think, is additive in an interesting way to what the book is doing. I don't think all of it is successful, but each variance, I'm like,
we like a
I wonder why. That's interesting. Oh, I see why they did that. With Gentleman in Moscow, I'm not feeling the same neurons firing of like, because I thought the Three-Body Problem was a much bigger adaptation problem than Gentleman in Moscow myself. So I'm like, how are you going to do this? There's sort of a, how the hell are they going to do this element to Three-Body Problem?
I think that to make a comparison between them again, like, there didn't need to be any adaptation problems about A Gentleman in Moscow.
No, I don't think so. I think you could have trusted it much more. I agree.
Yeah, I think they could have just leaned into it. And that languidness, like, I hadn't really pinpointed it, but it sort of just clicked for me as you said the word languid, that like some of it too is that we have now all lived through a period where you're trapped in a home, you're trapped in a place, and your, you know, mobility out of that place is either very limited or non-existent. And so we all do know the feeling of, you know, he is in a 100 square foot room in the book, and then he gets to go down into the hotel and get his hair cut, and he like has this little community that he interacts with. And in some ways, that is more expansive and varied than what the early COVID experience was like. Yes. But we all do now know experientially and in our bones what that kind of repetition is, what it's like to be like, okay, I guess I'll wash the dishes just to have something to do. Yeah. And then to look at the clock and be like, okay, that took 2 minutes. What am I going to do with the other 23 hours of my day while I can't go anywhere or talk to anyone or do anything? And I don't know, it's not the show's fault, but I think if you're making a show like that, or you're writing about that experience, like considering that the audience now all know what that is like and that you have to serve that in some way, I think would have benefited them of like, we do all point. Right. Like we can all relate to something about how he's feeling. And those early chapters of the book where it's like, he's doing the exact same thing day after day and week after week, he's, you know, going to read a chapter of Montaigne and then looks at his watch and it's like, oh, it's only been an hour. When do I get to go eat lunch? You know, like how much, like you're trying to keep your schedule. You're trying to be a person who lives like in something that resembles your normal life, but you have all these constructed circumstances where you can't. And I feel like they just missed that completely, that like we do know how that should feel and they haven't captured it for him or for us in A Gentleman in Moscow.
And I think in both our real world experience and also in A Gentleman in Moscow, we also found compensations, right? We wouldn't have chosen this, nor because we've shown COVID, but we also found some things, and some of them we have jettisoned and some of them we have retained, and some of them like there were, I don't think silver lining is the right thing, but a stripping away and stripping down, I think a lot of people clarified things they care about.
Yes. Right?
The travel FOMO that continues, for example, I think is one thing people tend to care about. I think I'm not sure what's going on still in the worlds of business attire or going into the office every day just because that has not come back. But there were some things to be found. The central questions are much the same, whether or not you're in COVID or not. You may have to deal with them or navigate them differently, but it's a good one. The timeliness thing I was thinking about, did they get to the headsets in the first episode? I can't remember. Of
yes.
Body problem?
Okay. Yeah, she puts on one of the main characters like gets the golden headset that had been at the house of the woman who just died. Puts
so
it
there
on
are these
and,
headsets that are super, super advanced VR headsets. And I thought, what unbelievable timing to come out like 3 weeks after the Apple Vision Pro is in the world.
Yeah.
Like, we have like, we've lived with these, the Oculus and the Meta thing, whatever. But like the idea of a headset and the encroachment of a digital projection as substituting an AI and everything, there's some interesting just sort of like cultural currents that are flowing into making the three body problem seem relevant in an interesting way. Where, I mean, you know, science fiction can be relevant later, it can be relevant never, but there was a weird timing thing of like putting these things on and having a different kind of experience is in the water a little bit in a different way before. All right, we better proceed. Let's do one more sponsor break here. So what all we have left is things the another one I've seen. I'm looking at my list here.
Masters of the Air, yeah. And then you can talk
so
about
Dune.
So
why don't you go, you do Masters of the Air, I'll do Shogun, and then I'll do a coda with Dune.
Oh, well, I think I talked about it a little bit on a recent episode when we were talking about Band of Brothers and realizing exactly how hard it was to make Band of Brothers as good as they made it.
Masters of the Year. It is not Mad Libs, World War II, get some dudes and see what they do for this particular.
Right.
It's not that simple.
It's really special. And like they have run, the gang is back together for Masters of the Year. This is produced by the same people that produced Band of Brothers. It's, you know, it's a Tom Hanks, Steven Spielberg joint functionally. It's beautiful. It has that Apple money look. It's gorgeous. And the cast is beautiful and expensive. Austin Butler and, you know, Callum Turner and a bunch of other great folks. We've watched six episodes. We hit the sixth episode like 4 weeks ago in my house, and we are meaning to get around to the end of it.
And they're all out.
They're all out. They've all been out. Yeah. And around, I think the first two I found really compelling. These guys are great hangs. Butler is so fun to watch on screen. Callum Turner is really fun to watch on screen. They have good chemistry with each other. There's not enough time to get attached to any of these characters before they start experiencing the horrific things that they experience flying into battle every week. And it is sort of a mission of the week setup. Every week they're getting in their planes and they're flying over some other part of Europe to try to drop bombs to defeat the Nazis. And a bunch of them are dying and it's horrible. But it moves so quickly. I think trying to be in service of faithfulness to these real people and their real story, that some of them die before you had a chance to like get attached to them. There are a couple episodes where like neither of the main characters is present for any of the action of the episode. And it's kind of, I'll spoil stuff now too. Like there's a moment where it looks like Austin Butler's character, like his plane might have gone down, he might be dead. Same with Callum Turner. And I remember like Austin Butler's plane goes down in like the third or fourth episode. And I turned to Bob and I was like, there's no way he's dead. Like, I've seen too much television to believe that they're killing off this guy this early in the series. But then you spend the next couple of episodes like without that charisma and magic on screen, and new characters come in, like it mimics reality of what happened here, that a lot of young men died and they just brought in new young men to take their place. And a lot of them died, but on as a show it doesn't give you enough time to get really attached to any of the characters, and it just it feels beautiful and kind of hollow, which is a horrible thing to feel when you're watching something that should be so affecting. I will probably finish it just for the sake of finishing it, but when dinner's over in my house and we're talking about how we're going to spend our like hour of TV time before the evening winds down, it is not the thing that we are excited to watch. And I am very bummed about that, because there are some great performances and some beautiful cinematography, but just I think this one should have been a movie. Stretching it out into 9 hours made it too baggy, and maybe they could have like zoomed in to a couple of these missions and made it about like a more condensed period of time with these characters rather than trying to like tell everybody's whole story for a whole bunch of different characters. Also, it's narrated by a character that doesn't spend much time on screen in the first handful of episodes. So I spent a lot of time being like, wait, who is telling this story? Which one is he? Why is this? Why are we attached to this guy? Or why are we supposed to be? I don't know. It just didn't quite hang together.
This makes a ton of sense to me. I am super interested to watch it. I'd like to see it.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, art is, you know, anyone that pays any kind of even halfway serious attention to art understands in their bones. And I think this is one thing that AI utopians or whatever maximalists don't quite understand, is that there is an element of this that's alchemy. And it's alchemy that you don't know why it works.
Right.
You just don't know, because on paper, things can sound great and they don't turn out to be that. I think the most frustrating one is there's not something that's obviously wrong, but it still feels like a B+ versus something where there's like obvious flaws or it shouldn't work and yet it does somehow. So I haven't seen, and maybe it's out there, shoot me an email, podcast@bookriot.com, a why Band of Brothers works better than Masters of the Air. And like really breaking it down decision by decision. Because a lot of things you're saying, again, I haven't seen it and I'll be looking for it when I do, have similar choices in Band of Brothers, but for whatever reason doesn't feel like it gets in our way. Like there's episodes that take a character that we know a little bit, they become the main character for the full episode, then they recede into the background, and Dick Winters and Cap Nicks aren't there the whole time, and it works in a way that is hard to explain why that might be. Is it the magic? Is it the whole is greater than the sum of its parts? But like, there's a lot of what you're saying that you could say about Band of Brothers, but Band of Brothers just works better, it sounds like, for whatever reason.
I think that's right. And this is a detail, but I think it's a meaningful detail. A lot of the time that they're in these planes, they're flying at such high altitude that they have to have on oxygen masks. And you can only see their eyes and hear their voices. And other than Butler, a lot of the voices sound the same. And so in the early episodes, there's like very dramatic stuff happening while they're in the air, but it's really difficult to know who it's happening to, because they're like, it's all these young guys, most of them are white, and they've got on helmets, so you can't see, like, you don't get any of the other signals
speaking
about
through
their
radios through masks when there's a bunch of other stuff going on. That's super interesting.
Yeah, and it's like, oh well, that was Austin Butler, we know his character, or I know that like he's in this plane, so that's the guy that's next to him. But not being able to see their full faces and have them doing like full face work in the most emotional moments of the show, I do think does the characters a disservice. And there's no historically accurate way to get around that. But it wasn't an issue in Band of Brothers because the technology is different at the time. So you're just, you know, on the ground with those guys watching their faces the whole time. And I don't know, I haven't really, like, I haven't felt really emotional watching Masters of the Air. And I get teary at the idea of watching Band of Brothers again. So, like, I think I'm still crying from that the first time.
Interesting. Okay. Let me do Shogun and then Dune real quick. Shogun is the best TV show I've seen in a long time.
That's compelling.
Long time. It is based on James Clavell's 1973, I think, blockbuster novel, historical fiction set in the time when Europeans were coming to Japan for the first time. The main character, well, one of the great things about these multimodal shows where you have multiple main characters that have multiple points of view and different scenes and everything built around a different one is they put in pieces and combinations to attack, like they say in Searching for Bobby Fischer. And the Secessions, the Mad Men's, the Game of Thrones, the Sopranos do this masterfully, right? Where you've got several sort of centers of gravity, their own kind of three-body problems, I'd say, where they're moving around each other and creates an interesting chaos and interaction. But the action is initiated sort of on two fronts. On the Japanese front, and I think it's an interesting contrast with Gentleman in Moscow, where Shogun, it more drops you into the world, and the characters are talking to each other, so they're not explaining it like no one doesn't understand the politics of feudal Japan, right? You have to kind of like, you get it, right? Okay, you can kind of put the pieces together, enough is being said, and probably they maybe say something a little more overtly than they would otherwise. But you get the idea that things are chaotic, there's some intranicene warfare going on and some machinations, and they have their own thing going on. And then an English sailor, let go for a second, who's supposed to be speaking Portuguese when, just let it flow over you, like the water off a duck's back. That'll help you. But he comes in as a Protestant who has multiple motives. One is to basically lay siege to these Portuguese Catholic colonies that have been in Japan for a while, that have cordoned off Japan to trade, and some other things are going as well, but also to make his fortune in his own way. And then he becomes an interesting pawn in a larger, basically, game being played. And that, so there's palace intrigue, there's fish out of waters on multiple sides, there's just like the world building. They must have spent $1 billion on costumes. Like, I think they spent all their money on costumes, and all of the everything else is in the mist, so you don't have to see the background or where they are. No, that's what I would make, because the costumes are so compelling and the sets are so compelling that it'd be too expensive to have everything else going on. So, like, the dress and the mannerisms, and they're really the subtitling and the Japanese. It's really, really cool just to be in this place that feels like almost another world. It has a dreamlike quality to it, and then the intrigue has a momentum of its own. It's really interesting. The language is really good. The dialogue good. The performances are excellent, and not for nothing, they knew what the story is. Like, the book is done. This is a limited series. This is going to be done. There's no Shogun 2 that can really happen without Godfather doing it, or just sort of create something out of whole cloth, which it sounds like they're not going to do that. So there's a satisfaction of, I guess, to go back to the central Game of Thrones problem, is trying to sail without a map, I guess, to continue the maritime metaphor. But this has an end, and what happens to like three different characters is sort of the plot, you feel like, by the end. And it's terrific. It's Hulu. It's not as bloody or sexy as Game of Thrones, but there's a boob and some people getting their head cut off. But it's not like full brothel. It doesn't go full brothel or full evisceration. Well, I don't know what to say. Like, the MPAA of Jeff is like, okay, whatever. But like, so it definitely isn't. My son was asking because he's like interested. He's like,
one boob.
He's 13. It's like super borderline for me about whether or not it's okay for him. Probably fine, but I'm like, okay, I'm not sure. Can we do some other stuff for a while? Can we give it 2 more years so we can come back to it? It's not going anywhere. But it's not bloody in the way that Game of Thrones was. I think the early scenes of Game of Thrones and the sexual politics of it feel like they're from a different world. And certainly the sexual politics of 16th century Japan or 17th century Japan, I guess it is, would be a choice you could make, but that is not spotlighted, I should say here. The women...
I appreciate that.
Characters, I think are probably the most interesting characters in the adaptation. I cannot speak for firsthand knowledge about what the original source material is like. I never read Shogun. I thought maybe I had, but in hindsight, I think I'd read something else said in the same period. So it's fantastic. If you're all into good television, and I guess I'm now speaking you directly because you weren't going to be on this, I think it's worth giving it two episodes. Okay. If you're out, you're out. I could be wrong, but I think it's good enough that it sort of does the thing that Game of Thrones or Mad Men does, where I don't know if you don't need to care about advertising or Westeros. It has a thing that's its own. It's set in those worlds, but it has a thing that can transport you through those if you're like have a hard time bumping up that stuff. I think it's really terrific. So highest recommendation.
Cool. That'll go on my catch up list for sure.
Dune 2. I think it came out on HBO last week, so it's having its... I can tell from internet discourse that those who didn't see it in the theaters, or now it's easier to screen cap and make GIFs out of and stuff, so it's around a little bit more. I thought it was terrific. So did my son. Michelle did not care for it as much. She thought it was indulgent, overlong, and reductive. And she might not be wrong in a way. I think I found those things pleasurable. Like, Villeneuve is in his bag here. Like, he's going to do Villeneuve things. He had all the money in the world. He's got big stars, a meaty, mythological subject. The big loser, weirdly, out of Dune 2 is Star Wars in this way, because Lucas was so inspired by Dune that he did a kid's version of it. And Dune is not a kid's story. Like, Dune weirdly is like commentary on a Star Wars story that inspired Star Wars to exist. Like, my mind warps at the very thought of it, because it's commenting on messiahs and on power, on, you know, inheritance and chosen ones. And it seems so weird. It has a Watchmen-like, without even knowing it, it's commenting almost on the last 10, 15 years of franchise IP. All of the things that, many of the things that went into the MCU, Star Wars, you know, DCU, are kind of undercut while also trafficking in the same time. I don't know how they did it. I need to see it again. So I think it's more intellectually interesting than I was expecting it to be. And then there are some cinematic things that I've never seen before. And Chalamet's terrific. And Bardem is having the time of his life. And I could watch Zendaya do everything. Like, and Rebecca Ferguson is transcendent. And you know what? Giant worms are cool. Giant worm Shotwell are cool. Like, there's a scene when Paul is first trying to ride the sandworm, that I was like, how are they going to make this not seem idiotic? And damned if they didn't make it seem not idiotic somehow. I was really impressed. I would like to warn every people for Dune 3 and any subsequent movie, it is going to get extremely weird. And it's weirder than this is even hinting at. It gets weird. God Emperor of Dune, they probably shouldn't even try to make. And that's someone who really likes Dune. Don't do that. Please don't.
I will stay tuned for your review of the weirdness.
Yeah. What did Nelson say, by the way? I meant to text her about Dune 2. Did she like it? Or did Bob like it?
Yeah.
What did they think?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. They both really liked it. Bob enjoyed it, said it was great, and he also said the story gets much weirder from here, and that the film set it up to have a third one. And he was like, but I don't know how they're going to do that.
I think the third one might be okay. It's the next ones after that I'm concerned about.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think overall folks seem to really love it. I think at some point, I will pull a Jeff O'Neill and I will probably watch these on a plane.
There you go.
And just catch up. Like, let it get weird. It's not going to give me an existential crisis at 30,000 feet. So that's good.
I'm sort of guessing, and maybe you can O'Neill's razor in this regard, which is I'm sort of guessing that the third of these Dunes will be the end of the Villeneuve, Chalamet, Zendaya trio. I think they're going to do this one. And that'll probably be it. And if they do Dune 4, it'll be someone else with some other, you know, in some other part of the galaxy, and they'll be out. Because I think Herbert, again, there's enough talk of drugs And Herbert is a weird enough guy, and then he has a son get involved, and we all know how that can go when someone takes on the estate and they want to take their own spin on things. And it becomes a lot less mainstream legible, I guess is a kind way to put it.
Interesting. Okay.
I can do some weird, but like Ames is reading Dune right now. He's like, should I read the rest of the series? Like, well, maybe the next one after this, but after that, I feel like I can't in good conscience recommend them. Now, maybe that leaves some interesting terrain. Say, well, let's not worry about doing that. That would be cool. I guess I'd be more. That's one of the rare times I'd be like, yeah, just go off script. Start with a blank page and say, okay, what happens? But
interesting.
I'm also glad I saw the original Dune because it was in the middle of COVID, just at my home TV. I got a good TV and it's a nice setup. But going to the theater, the shit is loud.
Yes.
It's amazing.
You gotta go to the movies.
Just as a cinematic experience, I almost feel like if you don't need, that would be the sadness about seeing it on a plane. Would be that there's a part of it that you want to see a 15 foot tall sandworm ace some dudes.
That's
and it looks
true.
Amazing.
Maybe they'll put the first two back in theaters a little bit before the third one comes out, because that does sound good. And
it
I think
also
we all,
doesn't. Go ahead.
I was just saying, if you're still in the post-COVID, like, maybe I don't need to go back to the movie theater feeling, like, you do. You need to go back to the movie theater.
It's different. If you liked going before, you'll like it even more now. Please do. The other thing I'll say about Dune 2, and, you know, I am no cinematographer, but the effects don't feel like bog-standard, expensive special effects. If you know what I mean, it's like, there's sort of a familiar special effects and comic book movie thing that doesn't feel like it's changed a whole lot. I'm sure as the technology's gotten better, there's some things I would notice. But this feels much more lived in. Like, it doesn't... I know there's computer graphics. There has to be. But there's not as many shots where, like, oh, that's CGI. There just aren't. There just aren't. And I think they're making some decisions so that they're downplaying what they would need to use it. But also, they're choosing effects that, even if they're done in computer ways... the computer effects seem more real, and it's mixed with more practical stuff. Like, there's this one scene, I've never seen anything like it before. A couple of shots I've never seen anything like before where, you know, the Fremen, which is basically this band of, resistance fighters / terrorists, depending on which side of this thing you are on, which they're resistance fighters. The Harkonnens are colonizers and violent thugs, but they're attacking this big metal thing. Was it a harvester, a tank? Doesn't matter. But these, like, mines come flying. They're, like, magnetically done, and they come flying out of the sand. I just never seen anything like it before. And it's a small thing. And then these Harkonnen soldiers, the bad guys, I guess, to use the shorthand, they have jetpacks so they can, like, fly. But they don't fly like people in jetpacks you've ever seen. They sort of, like, float, kind of like Mary Poppins style. And they don't need to do a big takeoff or big landing because they're just, like, I just never seen stuff like that before. And Villeneuve is a wonderful visual storyteller, and he gets, because the story is already done and a lot of the stuff is totemic lines, he doesn't have to create a lot of dialogue, but it really makes for a kind of magical cinematic experience, the kind of thing movie theaters were made for. So it was terrific. I'm grateful to see it doing quite well. I think that's good for a lot of people involved, and I don't know that we've ever seen a tentpole sci-fi franchise catch stars at the peak or near peak of their stardom. Because even something like Star Wars or the MCU, like Downey Jr. was a beaten down commodity, and then they cast a lot of people we didn't really know that much for a lot
of
different
reasons. It's hard
to
remember that that's how it was at the beginning of Marvel.
That was a huge risk.
Yes. Yeah.
Star Wars is a bunch of unknowns. Like, Harrison Ford had been American Graffiti. Like, this is just something and people have tried this before, and it's just never worked. It just hasn't come across. So, I'm thrilled that it exists as a science fiction nerd and a Dune lover and a book lover and someone who likes the movies. I don't know what else do I want, Rebecca? If I don't like this, what am I doing?
I mean, it sounds pretty ideal. I don't think I'm going to have anything this exciting for you in next Wednesday's episode where we preview the next season of adaptations.
Well, what could be even more exciting? I don't even know, right? Yeah. Like, I don't even know what I would ask for.
Nothing's
going to
come close. This was the thing. This is the story of the year in adaptations.
Yeah,
Dune just is.
I think so.
It's hard
so,
to get bigger than that in many senses.
I wonder how the book sales have been. I haven't looked too closely at, like, the PW paperback.
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
You would think,
like,
people
pop.
Are picking it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a commitment. you know, it's not, if you go in, it's a 300 page thing, that's different, but this is a thick, chonky boy to pick up there. Okay. Well, that's a lot of fun. Podcast@bookriot.com. If you want to give your 2 or 3 cents on any of these shows, or if you agree or disagree with any of our mostly correct and unassailable takes, you're welcome to do so. There'll be show notes, bookriot.com/listen, though I don't know what will be there. Probably just links to Patreon, Deep Dive, other kinds of stuff. But other than that, Rebecca, thanks so much. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.